Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In our podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. In 2019, the Honorable Deborah L. Stevens was unanimously elected by her colleagues as the 57th Chief Justice of the Washington State Supreme Court. As Chief Justice, she's the court's chief spokesperson, presides over Supreme Court hearings and conferences, and co-chairs the state's Board for Judicial Administration. Governor Christine Gregoire appointed Chief Justice Stevens to the Washington State Supreme Court on January 1, 2008. That fall, the people of Washington elected her to serve a six-year term and re-elected her in 2014. Prior to her appointment, Chief Justice Stevens served as a judge for Division III of the Court of Appeals. She's the first judge from that court to serve on the Washington State Supreme Court, as well as the first woman from Eastern Washington to do so. A native of Spokane, Chief Justice Stevens attended Gonzaga University School of Law as a Thomas More Scholar, entering law school when her daughter was just 5 weeks old. Chief Justice Stevens regularly attends youth and access to justice events across the state, serves on the YMCA Youth and Government Advisory Board, and she frequently speaks at youth and community events. Chief Justice Stevens and her husband have been married for over 30 years and have two grown children. She enjoys skiing, golf, tennis, and spending time with her extended family at the Snake River. Chief Justice Stevens, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Eric. Thank you for inviting me.
These are strange times right now, and COVID-19 has changed education and basically our entire way of life in Washington State. What sort of impacts have you seen affecting the Supreme Court?
The impact has been incredible, and not just on the Supreme Court, but really on all the courts across Washington. And my number one responsibility as Chief Justice during this time has been to really assess and help respond to the impacts that are being felt. I mean, if you can imagine, the most vulnerable people in our society need to have access to the courts to protect very basic needs. I mean, everything from domestic violence situations to crimes to foster care and dependency matters and family law matters and the whole array of situations that people face. And that all has to happen. It has to continue happening despite this pandemic. And of course, it is no surprise that the governor's proclamation, as well as the federal proclamation and those in other states, recognize that court operations are essential, mm-hmm. They're part of a critical infrastructure. But that said, we can't do business as usual. So Right. Just like other Washingtonians, we're doing a lot of our work remotely. In the Supreme Court, the decision that we had to close the building was made just on the eve of a set of oral arguments. And so we did postpone those arguments because we were not set up to conduct them. But since then, we've ramped up, and the next set of oral arguments all through May will be held on the Zoom platform and broadcast live by TBW, also live streamed. We did our first argument in an emergency case that we heard on an expedited basis just yesterday. And that was the petition for writ of mandamus involving inmates at DOC, the Colvin versus Inslee and Secretary Sinclair case. And we heard that was our very first Zoom argument. But I would say that my top priority right now as Chief Justice is working closely with the presiding judges and all the courts, working with our justice partners in the branch and the other branches of government, to do our best to respond to urgent needs and deliver essential justice services in this really challenging time.
Do you find that given the remote technology that it's going fairly seamlessly?
Oh, seamless is not the word for anything during this time. Yes. You know, what really impresses me though is the creative, innovative spirit that a lot of people are bringing to this. So we have found ways to conduct business that have never been tried before, but it's been a constant task of making adjustments because so many laws and rules of the court require different operations. I mean, everything from how one signs a document to what sort of proceedings are required to happen generally face-to-face within X number of hours, of an arrest or an event. And when that's not possible, I will say a lot of what I've been involved in is looking closely at statutes and court rules and what needs to be modified to make this happen. As with many things, there will be a silver lining coming through this because we are being innovative and creative and finding that in some areas, the way we're operating now might be something we want to continue. But, you know, as one example of something that absolutely has to come back, but we cannot do it right now, that's jury trials. You know, it's a cornerstone of our democracy, the right to trial by jury, and it's just not safe to conduct those right now. So those have been suspended, but we're really looking at what the start date will be for conducting jury trials and how to do those safely. You know, a lot of our physical building space isn't adequate right now for what needs to happen, but we can make adjustments. And certainly we can do some things remotely, including some evidentiary hearings. But I think what the courts are feeling is what so many parts of our society are feeling: education, business, government. It's a constant challenge to just find new ways to do what you do.
Speaking of what judges do in Washington State, there are a lot of misconceptions about what they do and what they don't do. What would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions, and what are some of the things that people don't realize that judges do in Washington State?
Thanks for that question, because I think for many of us, and this was certainly my impression, I come from a family, no lawyers. My grandfather, Riley, said we lived unknown to the law until I decided to go to law school. So I really didn't have any firsthand understanding. And I think a lot of people think that lawyers and judges are academic and are, you know, having discussions with a lot of big vocabulary about esoteric things. And the reality is that most of the work in the courts, I mean, it is everyday social problems and problems involving the criminal law and situations that are tearing apart families. And so what judges really do every day is respond to those needs in increasingly creative ways. So the image that I think people have of, you know, the stoic person in a black robe sitting behind a bench and issuing a decision. And when you watch the Supreme Court, of course, we're hearing a case really on the law. We're not deciding facts. That's already happened. So it looks more like that when people watch us. But in the trial courts, I mean, 20th and 21st century courts are problem-solving courts. They are helping drug-addicted people who got into trouble with criminal law get into services and find ways to restore their life. And they're helping victims of domestic violence get support and the services they need. It's really much more dynamic. You know, I'm really proud all the time of the great work that judges are doing as really a foundation of how we can help the society function better. That's kind of the day-to-day work. It's probably helpful for people to know that our court system in Washington is not a single unified system. We have courts at the city level, you know, municipal courts. We have courts at the county level that only do limited jurisdiction matters like misdemeanors and low dollar civil matters. We call those district courts. They're purely county level officials. And then we have the general jurisdiction courts, which are one of the two levels of court called out in the Constitution. The only two levels of court are the superior courts, which is what we call that, and the Supreme Court. And then starting in 1969, the state created by statute the Court of Appeals just to really help with the workload, given, you know, the increasing complexity and size of Washington. But all of those courts, you know, are doing their job in discrete ways, and through a system of uniform court rules, the cases come up through the system, sometimes ultimately to the Washington State Supreme Court. But we see just a small fraction of the cases that the trial courts see. You know, our job is really just to help even out situations where there may be inconsistent practices in courts or where there's a big issue of statewide concern. But most of the good things that are happening in courts are happening at the local level.
Yeah, you talk about the courts being problem solvers. How would you say that the court system and the judicial system can support students in an equitable way? Because equity is a big focus of League of Education Voters, and we look at students who are furthest from what we call educational justice. What are the courts doing to support equity?
Yeah, that's a really important focus of courts, especially on the administrative side. If you look at the ways that students or young, let's just say young people come into the court system, mm-hmm. oftentimes it's been through what are sometimes called status offenses, you know, truancy or child in need of services or some of those type of offenses or juvenile offender matters. I think a big focus of the last many years has been to make those systems less punitive, more capable of integrating students into their school culture and their family culture. A number of schools have partnered with juvenile courts. I mean, I come from Spokane, and the West Valley School District and the juvenile court in Spokane put together the first student-run community-based truancy board years ago to help address those situations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think if you look at the caseload, too, that is in courts, a huge volume is in family and children's matters, child welfare issues, domestic relations issues. And in a number of ways, courts are always there to protect, you know, the best interests of children. Now, as to students in particular, of course, you're familiar with, you know, the number of ways that education issues come up through court systems.
Yes.
I mean, the Cleary case most famously, but there were many in just my time on the court, you know, there've been a half a dozen direct education-related cases about funding mm-hmm. or about records or about abuse that students suffer at the hands of the school employee. You know, there's always recourse on those types of issues in the courts as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the Supreme Court only sees a fraction of the cases that the other courts do, even superior courts. What is a typical day like in the Supreme Court, at least for you and for some of your colleagues?
Well, in the COVID-19 era, I don't know what a typical day looks like. You know, I yeah. became Chief Justice on January 6th, I think, and then everything changed. So typical is hard to define at the moment. But but in terms of the work of the Supreme Court and what my colleagues and I do together, so much of what the public sees of our work is just the tip of the iceberg, because a big part of our work is reviewing all the decisions in cases that would like to have Supreme Court review to decide which ones we need to take. The percentage has been fairly stable over the years that we take review only in about 10% of cases that seek review, because we're looking very carefully at, you know, emerging issues and themes and where the court needs to be involved. So that's a very careful process. We do that. The nine justices divide into two panels of five. I sit on each panel. We'll be doing that next week to look at a fresh crop of petitions for review. And then, of course, we're doing our casework. We're starting up May 5th, our first spring term mm-hmm. cases. We hold, unlike the United States Supreme Court, which has one term per year, and I think they're hearing 70 to 80 cases typically in that term, the Washington Supreme Court has three terms per year. We have one in the fall, one that starts in January, and one that starts in May. So our only off months are August, December, and April, when we're not hearing cases. So when we start up in May, you know, we're getting ready on all those cases. So all the behind the scenes, obviously reading the briefs and becoming familiar with the record, researching the precedent and the statutes or other laws that apply. And in that sense, our work is unaffected by the COVID-19 situation, because we do most of that in front of a computer or with a pile of reading. I've always said, when I talk to students who are interested in the law, I said, if you love to learn through reading and studying, the law is just a marvelous field to be in, because that really is how you do what you do, is you have to learn the history and the precedent and understand fully the situation of the case. So we do a lot of reading. And then we're coming together. We've been now for a couple months, I guess, a meeting by Zoom. So in addition to our casework, which we come together to talk about in conference, we have a huge administrative role. I mean, as Chief Justice, the majority of my job is administrative and statewide. But as a justice, even as an associate justice, close to half of your time is being involved in improving the administration of justice. You know, we have a commission on children and foster care, a commission, a minority and justice commission, a gender and justice commission, an interpreter commission, which is increasingly involved in issues of language access more broadly. Sure. And we have, I mentioned to you about the Civic Learning Council that I've been on for several years, and a number of groups that help convene really important work around social justice and access to justice and improving the experience of justice across Washington. So that's a big part of what justices are involved in too.
You talked about learning and the love of learning. What was your own personal education journey like? What worked for you and what didn't work so well for you?
So I come from, like many people who go into professional life, I'm a first generation college graduate.
Wow.
And my mother came from really desperately poor circumstances from Western Kentucky, and she was orphaned by the time she was 14 and Whoa. Had to leave school and support herself and her younger brothers and sisters. So she never finished beyond somewhere in the ninth grade. And yet she just had a real thirst for learning. So I have four sisters, and education was always emphasized in our household for a number of reasons, but mostly, you know, I don't think it was simply that, well, if you're going to have a good life, you have to have an education. I think it was also just, you have this opportunity that your parents didn't have, and why would you squander that? Mm-hmm. So I think there was always an interest that, you know, we should be as involved as we could with learning. I will say in my early years, I probably was not the most focused student. And I can't say that ever in my life I was one of those students who tried to figure out what the teacher wanted and do things by the rules. I probably was never that person. I was always just fascinated by, I could get drawn down a rabbit hole like nobody else just in following a thread of thought. Mm-hmm. I ended up majoring in philosophy in college. And I think it was partly just that I found it really interesting to try to think through, you know, how is it we know what we know and how do we relate to one another? And, you know, just those really universal questions, and just to see how there was almost nothing I could think of that somebody hadn't thought of before and written about. So I had a professor once who said, I think the words that describe me, he said, boy, when you get something right, you're really, really good. He says, but when you go off track, you can get really, really off track. And I thought, yeah, that shows the undisciplined student that I probably was. Mm-hmm.
Do you wish you had some more structure growing up when you were in, say, elementary school or middle school or high school?
I do not. I don't think that's healthy. I think what I had was a little bit of chaos in our family situation. I mean, there was divorce involved and mm-hmm. other issues. And we spent a lot of time in the outdoors alone. I mean, you know, no shoes from the day school got out until the day school got back in. And I think a lot of that just freedom is not a bad way for kids to learn, as long as, you know, the opportunities are in front of them. So, no, I think when you impose your own structure, you know, as it comes to you and your desire to slow things down or try to come to a very concrete solution, that it's more meaningful. So no, I don't have any regrets about all of that happening. I mean, I think with a lot of kids, you just let them spin until they settle. And when they find their own way to settle, it sometimes will just blow you away at what they come up with that you could have never taught them. So I think there's some value in that.
Well, that brings me to my big question that I like to ask everyone, which is, if you were in charge of our state education system and you didn't have any budgetary constraints, what would you do? What would you change?
Well, the first thing is that I would see that educators, both certificated teachers and paraeducators and everyone involved in the system, the counselors, the librarians, were compensated at a level that reflects the critical importance of what they do and were given a little more freedom to do it well. You know, I feel like I grew up in more rural areas. I mean, good Lord, I started school in Steptoe, Washington, in a small area outside of Spokane.
And wow.
I was a school board director at a very small non-high district north of Spokane for about a dozen years. And, you know, you just see time and again, when you give people some academic freedom to design programs that really work for kids, just great things happen. So in some ways, you know, maybe this goes back to my resistance of a lot of structure in my own learning. I think if you give people what they need to respond to what students need, a lot of great things come out of that, far more than when we try to overly standardize things. So that I would do. The other thing I think I would do is spread it out a little more. You know, I think none of us really loves sitting at a desk for hours and hours on end. And there's just a lot of other interesting ways to learn. And I understand there are safety issues and other social constraints around what we can do. But boy, if you could have smaller pods of students, you know, being able to do more interesting outdoor creative things all the time, the enthusiasm they would feel would just launch them. So that would be my vision of, you know, just a little more kinetic, self-directed, and that would just make for such a dynamic system.
Deborah Stevens is the Chief Justice of the Washington State Supreme Court. Justice Stevens, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Eric.
And thank you for listening. To learn more about League of Education Voters or to support our work, please visit educationvoters.org.